I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sports ad free. That's amazon.com/sports ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
My father always told me soccer is a poor man's sport. You know, you can't be a rich kid or have a rich kid mentality and excel. You got to be a poor man on the field that's hungry to eat.
Welcome to Coffee and Football. My name is Sebastian Alvarado, and I'm the host of this long-form interview-style podcast where each week I sit down with some of the most interesting and influential people involved in the game. They range from players to club and league executives to corporate brand directors to media profiles, agents, and thought leaders. I've always been intrigued by the behind-the-scenes types of stories and curious in learning about people's journeys and wanting to understand how they got to where they are. The purpose of these conversations is to dig deep and get to know the person behind the title and to learn about their work, everyday routines, life experiences, and to hear their side of the story. On that note, it's time for the very first episode. I had the opportunity to sit down with Aleko Eskandarian, the assistant coach of the New York Cosmos. He's a former MLS professional, having played for 5 different clubs, as well as represented the U.S. national team. His name was actually one of the first ones I wrote down when thinking about who to approach for this series. Not only for his career accomplishments in the professional game, but also to learn about his journey as one of the biggest talents in the early days of the league, his Armenian background and influences, and perhaps even more so for the adversity he's faced and gone through. I wanted to learn about that other side of being a professional athlete when things aren't always going as planned. Aleko is a great example of somebody who hasn't always had an easy route, and he's very open about it. He has an amazing ability to tell this story. So without further ado, I hope you enjoy this conversation as much as I did. Welcome, Aleko, to the Coffee and Football Podcast.
Thank you so much. Pleasure to be here.
How are you doing today?
Pretty good, pretty good. Lovely day in New York City, so I can't complain.
Since the theme of this really is a coffee conversation, my first question has to be, do you drink coffee?
You're going to be surprised on my answer.
God damn it. You're really missing out. So you never had a cup of coffee?
Never in my life.
Why?
Never in my life. You know, as a kid, I was like the most hyper energetic kid. I was like running around bouncing off walls, and I just remember everyone saying like, man, this kid's never going to need a cup of coffee in his life. And as I grew older, I saw like my dad, my brother, they can't go a day without drinking a cup of coffee. And they're like, oh, I have a headache if I don't drink my coffee. And I'm like, you know what? I'm just going to steer clear of this. I got a couple weird things. I've never had bacon in my life. I've never had peanut butter in my life.
Today, you're the assistant coach at the New York Cosmos. Is there any additional pressure because you are the New York Cosmos and because you're in New York City? Or
Absolutely. You know, that's part of being on the New York Cosmos. You have to be someone who embraces pressure. And I wouldn't have it any other way. To me, that's the whole reason I'm even coaching right now, is because I love pressure. And I enjoy the pressure of playing. And there's no way to replicate that in life after you're done. But this is the next best thing of still feeling that pressure day to day and, you know, having that competitive spirit and wanting to achieve your goals. So
what do your mornings typically look like? Take me through your first 90 minutes.
You know, for me, this is kind of like a gloomy story, but, because of, my concussions that forced me to retire, I actually struggle with sleep. So I typically, as soon as any sort of light peers through my window or whatever it is, I'm up. So usually that's 5:30, 6 a.m. I'll try to get to the gym as much as I can, but usually I'll procrastinate on my phone, check my emails, do a lot of, I guess, work related stuff just with, you know, returning phone calls, or not phone calls that early, but texts and things like that. I can't tell you how many people have texted me back. I'm like, why are you responding to me at 5:30 a.m.? I'm like, cause that's when I wake up. That's when I do this stuff. But usually I'll just, get all that stuff out of the way and then focus on, you know, whatever the work is that day. So Gio is actually another guy who's up pretty early. So usually I'll correspond with him. We actually have a fun little game to see who's going to be up earlier on the day. But just seeing what the day calls for. And the cool thing is every day is different.
I want to get back to in just a little bit in terms of where you are today with your coaching and where you're headed with that. But I want to rewind the tape a little bit and start from the beginning.
Okay.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Montvale, New Jersey.
In order to get to know you, what do I need to know about that place?
Well, if you want to know me, it starts, you know, way before that, which is my roots, which I'm Armenian, Persian Armenian. Both my parents were born in Iran, but we're of Armenian descent. And, you know, my family came over to the United States through soccer. My father played for the old New York Cosmos. And that's what brought my family over. And they settled in Jersey. I have an older brother as well. So we're very much a soccer family. So I just grew up around the game. You know, my earliest memories as a child is me in Giant Stadium in the locker room, juggling a ball with Carlos Alberto and Beckenbauer and all these legends, Kinalia, guys who as a 3-year-old, 4-year-old, I thought they were just my friends, that I got to kick the ball around with. And, I grew up with the game. You know, I don't think you could find a photo of me as a toddler without a ball in my hands.
Yeah. And I assume that your dad obviously was, has always been a huge influence for you. What are some of the main kind of learnings that you take from him that you learned back then that you apply today?
Yeah, my father is definitely, you know, everything, you know, I could ask for in terms of a role model and someone that has taught me everything I know about the game and life. More than anything soccer related, my dad is just a phenomenal person. So that's always kind of what stuck with me. You know, whenever people talk about, you know, filling my dad's shoes and living up to, you know, to the family name and, you know, and whatnot. For me, it's more about how my dad carries himself on a daily basis. You know, he's a World Cup veteran, one of the greatest players in his country's national team. And with the Cosmos, one of the most, you know, beloved.
Did he play with Armenia or with Iran?
With Iran. Yeah, which is a feat in itself. And that goes way back. I don't need to look through the stats, but I think he might have been one of the first Christian players to play for Iran. And especially at that time, it was a sensitive subject. So he had to deal with a lot of different things as well that, you know, are foreign to me that I would never comprehend. But, you know, my dad has an incredible story, and the way he kind of persevered and excelled, and the stories that I've heard about him and that he's told are phenomenal. So, my dad is an inspiration every day. You know, just like I said, seeing how he has remained humble and genuine, throughout any successes or failures or whatever it is, it has been most inspirational.
Do you speak Armenian?
Yeah, my first language is Armenian. That's what we spoke at home. You know, my parents didn't speak English when they moved here, so I spoke Armenian at home and went to an Armenian school actually growing up. So Armenian is very much embedded in my being and my culture, and it's a big part of who we are.
On that note, and a lot of the Armenians that I've come across in Iranian, I grew up with a lot of people from that region. But even here in the States, a lot of them are very prominent in their fields and whatever they are, and they have a certain character. But there is, I think what you just touched on, there's a humbleness, but then there's a certain drive that it's quite unique. Is there any way that you can sort of explain, like, where does that come from? Are there certain things that they teach you or feed you or where does that come from? Because there's a lot of successful ones.
It's all in the shish kebab, man. That's where it all comes from. No, it's tough to really explain. You know, I have to say it's in our blood. You know, I know obviously with our history, you know, if you date all the way back to the genocide and all the different things that our people have had to deal with, there's a huge sense of pride that, you know, there's not that many of us in the world. We're not the most populated race, I guess, in the world. But you know, I think William Saroyan, who's a phenomenal Armenian author and poet, he said it best. You know, anywhere that two Armenians can meet each other, they'll start a new Armenia, because it's that bond between, you know, all Armenians that, you know, you have to work for everything you get, but still remain humble. You know, it's a beautiful thing. Our culture is phenomenal. Every Armenian person I've met, even throughout my career, I can't tell you how many times, maybe in every stadium I've been to, people that don't even know me, you know, I'll see an Armenian flag in the corner of the stadium and someone calling me over, and you go and like, oh, I know so-and-so that knows so-and-so. And it's like your family. So for me, it's been an honor to, you know, represent my culture every time I step on the field, or every time I, you know, find any success as a coach or anything. I'm happy to talk about it and also educate people about it, because there's way too many people that don't know the Armenian story, especially, you know, going back to the genocide and the struggles of getting that commemorated on an international basis. It's tough when government and politics get involved. It's a very sensitive subject, but I think all Armenians live with that. And we kind of choose to allow our drive and our success to kind of speak for ourselves.
I probably don't even need to ask you what your dreams were growing up, because I think you were just put a ball next to you and told that this is what you're going to do and be, right?
Yeah, no, I think it was never forced upon me at all. That's the funny thing. It was a misconception when I was younger. People thought, you know, you had no choice. You know, right. Your parents forced you, but it was the opposite. I was just obsessed with the game. I think it helped that I had an older brother as well who was kicking the ball around. So I kind of mimicked him and always competed with him. But, you know, my parents, they were open to whatever. You know, they would take the ball away from me as punishment. You know, if I wasn't listening or if I was being a bad kid, they would say, okay, no soccer practice this week. And I would cry and lose my mind. So, you know, by no means was it ever forced on me. My mom could probably tell you some great stories about, you know, middle of the night, no one could find me, and I'm out in the park or whatever playing on my own, just with a ball, dribbling and trying to do different things. My parents, you know, worried sick, thinking I, you know, disappeared. But I was always obsessed, you know. Soccer for me as a kid, as much as, you know, I loved the game and it was fun, it was an outlet for me to express myself. Like I said before, I had so much energy growing up. I was always kind of running around, bouncing around here and there. I got in a lot of trouble as well. And because of it. So soccer for me was a great outlet to kind of express myself, have that creativity and individuality, and also know there was something there that I could work hard at and show improvement with. And it was a fun game in my own head to play with.
So then you, in high school, you went to Bergen Catholic High School in New Jersey, right?
Yes.
And ended up, I guess, breaking all the possible records there were. And from there on, you moved to the University of Virginia.
Yes.
Just talk me through that process, kind of from high school, and then how you ended up at the college level.
Yeah, listen, I always had a chip on my shoulder. You know, even when I was a kid, competing with my brother, with, you know, older players. So I remember when I was in sixth grade, I was the ball boy for my brother's high school team, sixth, seventh, and eighth grade. And I would go watch these high school games, and I'd just be juggling the ball while watching the game. The whole time I'd be thinking, you know, I think I could be out there with these guys, and, you know, thinking what I would do instead of what this guy did, and just kind of studying and sizing up, you know, the level and the competition, all that stuff. So I couldn't wait to get out there. And my freshman year at high school, it was a bit interesting, because my school had a rule of no freshman could play a varsity sport, because we had a very good athletics at my high school, especially the football and basketball team and all that. And so they kind of made this rule of, you know, freshmen can't play varsity sports. And it like ate at me, man. So I was playing with the freshman team for a couple of weeks. And then I would go and I'd watch my brother. My brother was the captain of the varsity team. So then I would just go and sit there and just watch. And sure enough, one day early in the season, I think someone got injured and they needed someone else to jump in. So I jumped in, I think, you know, scored four or five goals in the game. And the coach said, okay, I think we're going to have to change this rule. So that's kind of how my high school career began. And then breaking in on that point. And then the next thing was to start winning with our team. So first it kind of started with my individual success of proving that I belonged at that level, because my high school wasn't known for our soccer team at all. And, you know, just having those local rivalries and things like that, trying to gain bragging rights for our school. And I individually did very well, but my school never really got the recognition it deserved. And even with me, people were like, oh, he's a good player, but he plays for a shitty team. So, you know, how good can he really be? What's the competition like? So my senior year, it became a huge challenge to say, okay, I know I'm the best player in this area. I know my team is not the greatest. How can I now be a leader? How can I help my get the best out of my teammates and be a winner? And so my senior year was phenomenal, man. Our whole group of athletes, of soccer players, they really put the work in, committed to it. It was such a fun team to be part of. We won a state championship and county championship and all this stuff, which, we definitely were not the best soccer team by any stretch of the imagination, but, it was fun to, for the first time in my life, feel like a leader. And I felt more satisfaction with that than anything that I'd accomplished individually.
And then you ended up at Virginia.
Virginia, that was interesting too, because, you know, for all my feats in New Jersey, I was really only recruited heavily by the local schools. You know, the Rutgers, St. John's, UConn, all those schools were the ones offering me full scholarships and things like that. But I was kind of a late bloomer on the international scene with the national team. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't until my senior high school that I finally got called into the under 17 national team. And when I did, right away I did well. Before that, I was kind of an unknown commodity. And I kind of had self-doubt as well. You know, when I was 15, 16, I always looked at, you know, we had ODP back then. So like state team, regional team players, national team players. I was like, oh man, those guys are, you know, a completely different level. And I remember my father telling me, like, listen, you can compete with those guys. You can be better than those guys. But I didn't believe it myself. And so it took me a while to mentally get to that point where I believed that I was better than those guys and that I belonged. So finally, my senior year of high school, I kind of went on a tear and did very well. But it was a bit late in the game in terms of college recruitment and things like that. So all the big schools, I wasn't really on the radar. But I had this dream of going to UVA, you know, growing up with the Bruce Arena teams and, you know, the Ben Olsons and John Harks and Tony Miola, all those guys from Jersey that, had gone there and found success. Those are the teams that I grew up watching. So I got very fortunate in that the assistant coach for UVA coached a regional team, an ODP regional team for an age group older than me. They needed some players and I got called in. We went to an international trip to Germany, competed in an international tournament against a lot of Bundesliga youth teams and did very well. And then the assistant said, listen, have you decided where you're going to school yet? I said, no. And he said, I'm going to talk to the coach and see if we can get you to UVA. So they actually gave me probably the least scholarship offer I had from all the schools that were recruiting me. But I spoke to my parents. It was actually between UVA and Princeton. Those are my final two choices. And looking back, I could have gone two completely different paths. But I told my parents, I said, listen, I just want one semester at UVA. I want to go there. I want to see where I measure up against the best soccer players in the country.
And you had the grades to get
in? I had the grades. Yeah, school was always important. That's like I told you, my parents, as much as, you know, soccer was a big part of our lives, school was always priority, always. You know, I couldn't do, if I wasn't doing well in school, I wouldn't be allowed to go train. You know, that was kind of the rule in the house. My parents put a huge, huge emphasis on education. And, you know, I got my ass kicked a few times by my dad if I, you know, wasn't doing the right things in terms of schoolwork. So, yeah, I was very fortunate that grades were not a problem for me.
Who else was on your team from the ones who made it up?
Yeah, the guys that made it, there was Kyle Martino, who's obviously now doing TV stuff, playing the league. Ryan Kelly played a bit as a pro. Who else we have? Marshall Leonard played in MLS. Kenny Arena, who's Bruce Arena's son, who also played a bit in MLS and is now coaching in MLS. We literally had a roster of professionals. You know, when I look back at our starting team, I think every guy played professionally or at some point was involved in a professional team. So it's different than in those days. You know, it was kind of unique for a player to be able to go pro at a young age. So college was very much the strongest players in that age group. And at UVA, it was, you know, it was like a professional team with the facilities that we had, the coaching we had, the players we had. It was a fantastic environment for us.
And all of that then led you to finally become a true professional. You were drafted as the number one pick in the country. Talk me through that. I've been in this country for many years. I still don't understand how that whole process works. Talk me through that. I know you ended up at DC United, and you know, what was that process like, and what was it like to be drafted by DC United? Did you even care about what team you would end up on? Or
it's interesting. Obviously, it's a unique setup. I mean, it's nerve-wracking for sure. You never know where you're going to end up. But once I decided, you know, I wanted to start my career in MLS, I wanted to play in front of my parents where my family could come watch me play, and also help the game grow in this country. Obviously, it was a new league and it was still very much developing. But I knew I wanted to be a part of it. And by entering the draft, it's funny because I used to go to DC United games because UVA was about an hour and a half, 2 hours away. So whenever some of my buddies that were with me on the Olympic team or on the national team would play against DC, sometimes we'd make the trip and go watch and try to support, you know, my teammates and things like that. And I remember watching DC play, and that year they were the worst team in MLS. And I remember thinking, like, man, this team needs a lot of help. So I you know, didn't know how it was going to work, whether they're going to get the first pick or not. And obviously they did. And New York, the Metro Stars, which was my hometown team, had the second pick. So leading up to the draft, I was actually in Portugal with the Olympic team for a tournament. And all of a sudden I got the phone call while I was in Portugal that US soccer needed me to fly down to Kansas City to be part of the draft because it looked like I was going to be the number one pick. So flew down on my own, on a whim, literally, like an 18-hour trip because there were last minute flight and delays and layovers and all this stuff. Finally got there a few hours before the draft, and, you know, was there with my agent and just started hearing all the rumors of, oh, you might get traded. And I think they, you know, the Red Bulls were talking about trading to get you and kind of bring you home, and then this and then this. And then I didn't know until I was, you know, sitting there and waiting for them to call my name. And finally, they said DC United with the first pick, you know, selects Aleko Eskandarian. And it was a dream come true. I went up there. Ray Hudson was the coach at the time. He was quite a character. And it started my career. And as soon as DC called my name, you know, I knew that they had been given a lot of offers, good offers. I remember my agent telling me that the New York offered Clint Mathis for the number one pick. And I remember thinking, like, man, Clint Mathis is one of my favorite players. Like, that's crazy that they would even offer him for me. That's, you know, I think I would take that deal. You know, Clint was one of the guys I really looked up to when I was in high school. I used to train with the Metro Stars, and Clint was there. And to this day, he's one of my favorite guys and a phenomenal player. So hearing that they were offering him and that DC turned it down and different things, I was like, you know what, man, these guys want me. I'm going to give them everything I have. So the moment they selected me, I said, all right, you know, New York is now, you know, in the rearview mirror, and I live in DC now, and I represent DC, and I'm going to give DC everything I have.
It is indeed an international friendly between DC United and Real Madrid. Now Gomez. Moreno touches on Escandarian.
Can you describe, I mean, this is a little more than 10 years ago. Can you describe what the MLS looked like back then and what soccer in general in this country compared to where we are today?
Yeah, well, first of all, I think there was 10 teams. I think that was it, 10 teams. And, you know, two conferences of five teams. So four out of five make the playoffs. And it was crazy. But the level, I'd argue, was a bit higher because with less teams, there was so much more competition for spots. Now with 20 teams and NASL teams and USL teams, there's all kinds of opportunities for every player to grow and develop and get their opportunity. With MLS, it was like, if you're not, you know, the creme de la creme, you're not going to get a look. So it was the top guys, you know, international guys, guys who were starters for their national team who'd be on the bench or would be cut. So it was very cutthroat. And it was great. The competition was phenomenal. With that said, the stadiums and fans and things like that, that was still very much a work in progress. The game was still in a development phase, growing. But, you know, our team was fantastic. You know, I was lucky enough that my rookie year, I honestly could do a TV show about, because first of all, having Ray Hudson as a coach, John Trask as our assistant coach, these guys were, you know, cartoon characters. And our team was such an interesting mix of veteran guys and young guys. So we had veteran guys like, you know, Marco Echeverri and Hristo Stoichkov, who's a legend. He was actually our player coach for that team, which was a show in itself.
He's quite a character, huh?
Oh my gosh. Hristo, I could write a book about.
All right. So give me a couple of anecdotes. I want to hear something about Ray Hudson and then definitely something about Hristo Stoichkov as well.
Well, Ray was, a huge character in terms of how his pregame speeches, man. His pregame speeches were unbelievable.
What were those be like?
They would just go off on a tangent to the point that he would get foam around his mouth and then just like spit on the floor in the middle of the speech. But he would just like get you so pumped up. I don't even know if half the stuff he was saying was true, of like, they don't believe in you. They're all doubting you. No one thinks you can do it. Da, 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 like just going on and on and on and just, pumping us up. And I remember being like, and feeling like it's a World Cup final and it's like the, you know, third game of the season, but. He had one of the best quotes in the history of soccer that year, which, we weren't scoring many goals. We weren't playing that well. And someone asked him, what's going on with your offense? It's not working. There seems to be, you know, no penetration, no runs. And he said his exact quote, which you should go look it up. He said, without penetration, it's masturbation. So I guess you could say right now we're just playing with ourselves. And I was like, man, this guy's going to be a phenomenal commentator one day. But, you know, it wasn't all great too, because we struggled. I wasn't getting much playing time. I was actually very, very frustrated individually. And I remember meeting with Ray and just, at one point I was like, man, he must have something against me. He, you know, didn't take all these offers, kept me with the number one pick, and then he doesn't want to play me. And he just had a philosophy where he liked to stick with veteran players and just thought those guys were more equipped to play and help get results. And it wasn't until about halfway through the season when I finally was like, all right, I gotta go talk to him, because I pride myself on never spoke to coaches. For me, it was, I put my work on the field. My play will do the talking. If you feel like it's not good enough, I'll work harder the next week. I kept doing that. It wasn't paying off for me. Finally, I said, look, I'd like to talk to you. And also I wanted to play because we had Olympic qualifying coming up. So I told him, I said, look, what do I have to do to play more? And he's like, let me ask you a question. How old are you? And I was like, I think I was 19, or I just turned 20. I said, I'm 20 years old. And he's like, you're so young. You have, you know, your whole career ahead of you. You're doing great. You're doing fantastic. And I'm like, man, you're telling me I'm doing great. I'm doing fantastic, but I'm playing, you know, the last 5 minutes of games. Like I need more. And he's just like, your time will come. Be patient. But, it was frustrating for me because I felt like I could offer more and I was ready to kind of make a splash. And then, you know, when you see the press clippings of, the number one pick bust because he's not playing any minutes and this and that, it was frustrating for me to not be able to show the fans, to show the country what I could do. And everyone just assumed that I wasn't good enough. And again, my crazy voice in my head and my chip in my shoulder kicked in. And so the next year, following that season, Ray got fired. And Peter Novak took over, and that changed my career because he gave me a fresh start. And so I put the work into to gain my spot and never looked back. Hristo, on the other hand, which I promised a Hristo anecdote, he was I think Hristo would be arrested in today's world if he was still a professional athlete, because that guy is larger than life in many ways. His personality, his talent, everything about him, culturally, you know, coming from Bulgaria, the life that guy has lived is not the normal life. But I'll tell you one quick story, which I tell people and people don't believe me. But we were in preseason in Florida. And I think it took him a few months to even learn my name. He used to just call me stupid. Hey, stupid, come here, stupid. That's what he said, because I had to shine his shoes too. But I think deep down he really liked me as well, because he'd always take me to lunch every single day. And so we're in preseason. He's like, hey, do you want ice cream? I'm like, yeah, I love ice cream. He goes, okay, we go get ice cream. You come to my room, we go to ice cream after the practice. I'm like, okay, great. He's like, who's your roommate? I'm like, Doug Warren. He's like, okay, bring Doug too. So we go, and I'm thinking we're going to drive around the corner to get ice cream or something like that. We drive like an hour to a different place. I guess he owned a house somewhere in Florida. And I'm like, what the hell did I get myself into? So we go there, we get some ice cream. We come back, and he's like, hey, ice cream good? I'm like, yeah. It's like, the best ice cream? I'm like, yeah, it was very good. We get to the car, and he's got a ticket on his windshield. And he's like, what is this? What is this bullshit? I'm like, I can curse, right? Is that okay? Okay. So he's like, what is this? What is this? And I'm like, Christo, you parked in a loading zone, man. Like, it's illegal. And he's like, no. This is wrong. This is wrong. We cannot do this. I'm like, what's this guy talking about? What do you mean this is wrong? You parked in a loading zone. You got a ticket. What are you going to do? This guy starts driving around looking for the police officer who gave him a ticket. He finally catches up with this guy who's now a few blocks away writing tickets somewhere else. He's kind of yelling at him, motioning him to come over. And the officer comes over and he's like, yeah, can I help you? And Risto's like, yeah, what is this? Shows him the ticket. The guy looks at him and goes, yeah, you're parked in a loading zone. So I give you a parking ticket. And he goes, no, you can't give me a ticket. And the guy's like, what do you mean I can't give you a ticket? And he goes, you cannot give ticket to another cop. And I'm sitting there in the backseat like, what is he talking about? Like, we're going to jail. What's happening? And the guy's like, you're a cop? And he's like, yeah, I'm a cop. And he's like, okay, well, where's your badge? And all of a sudden, out of nowhere, Christo pulls out a badge and he goes, FBI, Bulgaria. And I was just like, I remember sitting in the backseat of the car next to Doug Warren and Santino Quaranta. And we're just like, dude, he's in the FBI. Like, what is going on? What is happening? And so the police officer was so confused. Like, what language is that? I don't even understand this. And eventually, you know, we left and, you know, we all like stayed silent for like 5-10 minutes. Like, dude, how do we even talk to this guy about what just occurred? And finally, like,
did he get away with it though?
I don't know. He ripped the ticket. He just ripped it. I'm sure he never paid it, but, we're like, hey, Risto, where'd you get that badge, man? And he's like, the president of Bulgaria awarded me like an Interpol badge after he was World Player of the Year in 1990 or something, 1994 or something like that. And I'm just like, dude, you are a character, man. So needless to say, I never went for ice cream with Risto again, but that's just one snippet of our Risto Stoichkov story.
Peter Novak comes in, yep. You start playing, and this is in 2004?
2004, yep.
And you guys end up winning the MLS Cup.
We win. Basically the same roster as the year before.
What changed?
The coach. Leadership, man. You know, with all due respect to Ray, when Peter came in, he was like, listen, I don't care what you've done, who you are, what teams you've played for, national team or not national team, college rookie or veteran, I don't care. You have to show me that you belong on the field. And hearing that on the first day, I was like a dream come true. I'm like, thank you. Because I know I'll outwork anyone that I compete with. So to not have my age held against me or lack of experience or whatever was a blessing. Also that year, we re-signed Jaime Moreno. Jaime was a DC United legend who had gone away to New York, to the Metro Stars. Had injuries, thought he could never play again, had a spinal surgery, which is very risky. So he came back and he was like 60% at first. But I remember even those in preseason, I was like, man, this guy is such a smart player and has so many tools. And me with my mentality, I enjoyed working hard. I enjoyed doing the dirty work up top. And so I remember even in preseason thinking, man, I want to play with this guy because he makes the game easier for me and I'll run for him defensively. He doesn't, you know, let him save his legs or whatever, as long as, you know, we were very good compliments to each other. And we just developed this bond that worked out. And the entire season, you know, I think we were unstoppable, man. I can't think of a single game where I thought defenders got the best of us, because we were both so different and we worked so well together that it was really tough for any defense to match up with us. Because if you dropped your line and you know, were, you know, afraid of my speed, then Jaime would find those pockets and turn and run at guys. Or if you try to play a high line, Jaime was so good at keeping the ball turning and slipping through balls into me. And we just had a great team, great group of a mix of, you know, veteran guys, mid-level veterans, and young guys. We also had our captain was Ryan Nelson. We had Ernie Stewart, who was an incredible, you know, national team player. We had, who am I missing? That was also phenomenal. Ben Olsen was there. Nick Raimondo was in goal. We had Mike Petke in the back, Brian Nemoff in the back. Who else did we have? We had Dima Kovalenko, who's another one of my favorite players, you know, that I ever played with. And Freddie Adu was a rookie that year with us as well.
That's right.
Yeah. So we just had an amazing group. We all stuck together with everything that we did. You know, when, you know, most teams, when you go out, you got four or five guys that are kind of in a clique. This team, if we're going to go out, you know, for dinner or for beers, it'd be, you know, 16, 17 guys that would roll together. We were very much brothers on and off the field.
With all of the success in 2004 and you being such a prominent player in that team, where was the national team in relation to all of this?
Yeah, so 2004, I was still with the Olympic team. Mm-hmm. And we went to Olympic qualifying. Olympics were in Athens, Greece that year. And crazy, man, still stings me to talk about. But 2004, before the season started, we go to Olympic qualifying. Olympic qualifying was in Mexico that year. So the two strongest teams in CONCACAF are Mexico and the United States. We were in two different groups. And the way it worked was, first place in Group A would play second place in Group B. First place in Group B would play second place in Group A. Whoever won that semifinal matchup, those two teams would go to the Olympics. So, of course, we were favored to win Group A. Mexico was favored to win Group B. And we wouldn't face each other in the semis. We'd play, you know, maybe Costa Rica or whoever it was. Sure enough, and Mexico hosting it, no one expected them to lose, you know, any of their first round games. Sure enough, they lose, I believe, to Costa Rica in their last game. We win. So now Mexico finishes second in their group. We finish first. So we end up playing Mexico in the semifinals. Winner goes to the Olympics in Athens. Loser is out. It was one of the most surreal experiences of my life. I think there were 65,000 in Mexico City where we played, packed fans. And this is after 9/11. So 65,000 people chanting Osama bin Laden's name, cheering against the U.S. Yeah, it was. I've never felt so, you know, angry while in a match, while being on a bench. You know, there's gamesmanship and yelling stuff, and, you know, you have thick skin for that. But when you start, you know, putting a terrorist, it was, you know, I've never felt emotions like that during a game. And literally looking at, you know, a man, you know, with his child, you know, yelling Osama and, you know, celebrating the fact that, you know, thousands of Americans had been killed in a terrorist attack. And I felt disgusted. You know, I think it crossed the line a little bit. And to be honest with you, I think it had an effect on all of us, because we got our asses kicked in that knockout game. We lost 4-0. I think it was 3-0 at halftime. In addition to that, the day before the game, my best friend's sister passed away. And the assistant coach was actually my best friend's stepfather, which is Thomas Rangan. So Thomas Rangan's stepdaughter, who was and his stepson went to UVA with me. So I became quite close with his sister, and she passed in a tragic car accident. So I was a wreck. I think I was leading scorer of the Olympic tournament that year, but I didn't start in that game against Mexico. I came in the second half and the score was already 4-0, and it was just a helpless feeling. Where right off the bat, they jumped on us, the crowd. You know, you could tell some of our guys were shook and rattled a little bit, and just a terrible performance. And so we did not go to the Olympics that year, which still haunts me to this day. So then after that, after, you know, my performances during the year, the full national team started calling me. Bruce Arena was the coach, and it was crazy because I got called in for a couple World Cup qualifying matches, but they were during the MLS season, and my team did not release me because they were, some of them were friendly, some of them were not difficult opponents, and we were, you know, in a playoff run, and then in the playoffs, so I missed a couple of training camps. After the season, I got called in, and sure enough, when I went to camp, I ended up like tearing my groin. And so didn't get to play in the next few games, was out for, you know, a month or so. Then preseason started, and then I got a concussion, and I was out for a year. So
that was in 2005.
2005, yeah. And that was...
How did that happen?
So the one thing with my concussions, I really don't like talking about it. It seems more and more that I have to talk about it. You know, it's not so much about me. It's, you know, obviously to help other people, raise awareness for it and all that stuff. But 2005.
Have you been quite involved in that?
No. Yes and no. Privately, yes. In public, no. Because, you know, and I'll always be an advocate for anything I could do to help. But for my own mental health, it's sometimes difficult for me to talk about, you know, the things I had to go through. And, you know, I went through a very dark period after I was forced to stop playing. That was, you know, very challenging for me in my life. But mm-hmm. Yeah, in 2005, just went for a ball over the top, me and the keeper, and keeper came out with a knee up right through the skull and kind of was headhunting for me a little bit. I think took a cheap shot and knocked me out, and I was out for 10 months.
Then in 2006, you had quite a comeback.
Yeah, 2006, you know, during that time in 2005, it was a very frustrating year just because concussions, no one really knew, you know, how to deal with them or what to do. So I actually...
Just even at the global level, like you barely hear about it.
It's an epidemic for sure.
Yeah, I feel like here I've heard it a few times, but other than that, it's never highlighted.
Yeah, no, it's, I wouldn't wish it on my worst enemy, man, because you're forced to become your own doctor. You're forced to be honest with yourself about some real issues. And, there are things that, you know, if you really sit down and, you know, admit to yourself that you can't do physical activity, it's a pretty heavy dose, you know, to swallow. So it's a damning injury, man, because it not only destroys you physically, but also mentally as well. And it was tough because that year, people didn't know if I was going to be back or not come back, never play again. I didn't know either. So I had gotten some really faulty medical advice at first where, you know, I had a neurologist just tell me to take pills and that I'd be fine. And once I started getting vertigo and dizziness while driving and almost, you know, got into a life-threatening car accident because of it. I pulled over on the side of the road one day, and I just said, wow, something's wrong over here. So finally got a second opinion, and I saw a doctor who shut me down and just told me, listen, right now with the symptoms that you have, if you were to play and get hit in the head, you could potentially die. So I said, okay, I guess I need to take a step back away from the game. And that was not easy for me to do, especially with the crazy competitive side that I had. Peter Novak actually saved me in many ways because they told me all I could do is walk. You can't run, you can't do anything. So I said, okay, if all I could do is walk, I'm going to walk. I'm going to walk my ass off. So I told our trainer, give me every piece of equipment you have. I had like 20 layers of clothes on, middle of July, and I just walked around the field like 50 times. And all the guys on the team were laughing like, this guy's crazy. And finally, Peter saw me and he's like, I'm just sweating, you know, my ass off. He's like, what the hell is wrong with you, man? Why? It's, you know, 100 degrees outside and you're wearing all this stuff. You're going to die. Like, what's wrong with you? I'm like, look, man, I can't play. I don't want to lose my fitness. They told me I could walk. I'm going to walk. But just walking isn't enough. So I want to make it, you know, I want to get the most out of it that I can get. So I'm going to walk and sweat as much as I can so I don't lose, you know, my fitness. And he's like, listen, man, you're going crazy. Like, you got to go home. So he's like, I want you to get away from the team, get away from soccer for a little bit. He allowed me to go home to New Jersey and just kind of chill and relax, get away from the game. And it really helped me a lot to kind of get everything in perspective. and just to pray as much as I can that I'd feel better. And luckily, 10 months later, I felt better that I was clear to play.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
You ended up staying for 2006, then you were traded to Toronto FC, was that?
I played on four teams in 12 months.
Talk me through that just briefly, and what goes through kind of your head as a player. Again, because the system in the MLS is pretty particular in that sense that you're not really in charge of your own destiny, right?
Yeah, well, it was interesting. I came back 2006. I think I was a finalist for like comeback player of the year, and I made the all-star team and kind of back in the national team picture a little bit. And we had a good season. You know, we lost in the playoffs to a tough New England team, but you know, I dealt with a couple other nagging injuries and things like that, but I ultimately had a very good year. When the season was over, I'll never forget, my agent said, hey, Bruce Serena became the coach in New York, and he's interested in bringing you to New York. You know, would you be interested? Do you still want to play in New York someday? And I'm like, no, you know, I'm happy in DC. You know, we had a good year, and you know, I'm very content with DC. And I said, but you know what, if you want, you know, ask. I wonder how DC feels about me. I'm not sure if they want to keep me. And because I just got like a weird vibe. And I had just changed agents, and my agent was becoming prominent for sending players to Europe. So I had 1 year left on my contract. So I guess most people in MLS thought I changed agents because I was going to go to Europe and I was kind of setting up that move. So next thing I know, when my agent calls to find out if there was interest in sending me to New York, he calls me back and he goes, you're not going to believe this, man. They've already agreed to trade you to Toronto. And I'm like, what? What do you mean they've already agreed to me? How is that even possible? Toronto was a new expansion team. They just picked a coach. They had zero players at that point. And I'm like, listen, if they're going to trade me, tell them to trade me to New York. Like, how can they trade me to Toronto? And I was livid because I was very close with Peter Novak. And I'm like, how could they have traded me and not one person from the organization has called me? And so I was very, very disappointed. Left Peter a couple of nasty, messages, voicemails, just disappointed that he didn't speak to me about anything.
So he avoided it.
And he avoided it. And so the trade goes through. And actually, before the trade becomes official, Toronto calls me. And they go, listen, we're looking to get you here and all that stuff. And I'm like, look, with all due respect, I don't want to go. You know, I'm happy in DC, and if anything, I would rather go home and play in New York and Jersey. And they're like, oh, well, you know, we want guys that want to be here. So it's kind of delaying the process a little bit. All of a sudden, in the meantime, news release comes out. Peter Novak resigns as head coach of DC United and becomes an assistant with the U.S. men's national team. So then he calls me and he's like, listen, don't ever leave me a voicemail like that again. You know, you're my guy and all this stuff. And he's like, you know, it's just been a decision that was made by the front office. So I felt pretty helpless, but I was like, what can I do? It seemed like it was more of a business decision where they got a bunch of money for it. And they probably felt like I was going to leave, you know, the next year anyway to go somewhere else. So they got, you know, value for me while they could. And that's where I learned the business of soccer. And, it was tough, man. It was really tough because DC had become my family. You know, I gave them everything I had. I went through a traumatic experience and overcame it. And everyone there was, you know, from the front office down was family to me. And to just be sent away without any say, without doing anything wrong was tough. Finally, Toronto agreed to bring me in, and to be with an expansion team, that was just starting was quite an experience. And I ended up loving Toronto, the city, the fans, everything was fantastic, but the team was a huge project, especially coming from a team like DC United, where, you know, we were in 2004 and 2006, we were by far the best team in the league. To now go to a team that was considered the worst team in the league was tough for me. And did my best, gave it everything I had. And then halfway through the year, I think everyone on our roster, that started on our roster, got traded in Toronto. It was crazy. I think they had like 50 players that year because they made so many trades. And so halfway through the year, I got traded to Salt Lake. Played the rest of the season in Salt Lake. Proud of, you know, everything we accomplished there. But then my contract ended at that year. I went to Belgium. I was on trial at Standard Liège, which was a Champions League team back then. Felt really good there. Played well. They offered me a contract and were going to loan me for 6 months and then try to bring me in. So basically my agent called MLS and said, you know, I was going to go to Europe. And they said, you know, what would we have to do to keep you in MLS? And I'd say, you know, the only way I'll stay is if I'm playing in New York or in LA. So they found out that Salt Lake, you know, would be willing to trade my rights to Chivas USA, which was in LA. And so there it was from one January to the next, four MLS teams in 12 months.
And how was it at Chivas?
Chivas, I was there for 2 years. And it was good. You know, in terms of our team, we had a fantastic team, very good team, made the playoffs both years.
Who was there at the time?
Sasha Kljestan, Ante Razov, Jesse Marsh, Zach Thorne, Johnny Bornstein, Claudio Suarez was our captain, Paulo Nagamura. We had a very strong team, good young players, some veteran guys. You know, our team had a chip on its shoulder as well, you know, kind of being like the weird, you know, Chivas USA team, which no one really knew what the identity was or anything like that. But we just wanted to play good soccer and not worry about, you know, the image and all that stuff. So the soccer was good. Definitely learned a lot about myself, you know, in that time period as well. Because of different factors, it started feeling like more of a job because of different things. And so ultimately, it culminated with my trade to the Galaxy.
How was that experience?
LA was phenomenal. The Galaxy was a rebirth. I started having fun playing again, and it reminded me of my days with DC. And it was a very brief time. I think I only got to play 3 games before getting my last concussion. But in that month that I was playing, you know, Beckham had just arrived back from Italy, and we had a phenomenal team, man. I remember, you know, myself and Edson Buttle up top. Mike McGee was in the mix too, and Landon had kind of shifted to an outside midfielder. David Beckham was in the middle. We had Eddie Lewis on the left, who was a phenomenal server of the ball. And in the back, you know, so much experience with Greg Berhalter. Omar Gonzalez was a young guy. AJ De La Garza was a young guy. Donovan Ricketts in goal. We just had all the pieces, and it felt right. And we were on a roll. We won every game that I played with them. I scored 2 goals in those 3 games and just felt alive again. And we got to beat Chivas in one of those games that we played. So that felt redemption as well. And then we played against New York, which I made a habit out of always trying to show my best when I was here because my parents would be here and all that stuff, all my childhood friends. And that was the last MLS game I played. I scored probably my best goal of my career against New York. It felt great. We had a friendly match against AC Milan a week later. And a random fluke play of, you know, I'd already sustained 3 pretty bad concussions in my career up to that point. And on that day, just a cross in by Eddie Lewis, And Thiago Silva was actually the player marking me. He was playing for Milan at the time. I beat him to the spot, cross went over my head. So on the backside, he just tried to clear the ball and just ended up clearing it right into my face, broke my nose, and just gave me another concussion. And I never recovered.
Wow. Quite incredible how these things happen to certain people. What are the odds for getting that so many times? I mean,
yeah, people always ask, is it, you know, the style of your, how you play and all that? And I'm sure that has something to do with it. You know, I believed in, you know, giving it everything I had when I was out there. I never held back, even if the odds were not in my favor. But when I look back at the concussions that I had, I wouldn't have changed anything in terms of, you know, when Eddie Lewis is going to cross the ball, I'm going to attack the spot, man. I'm going to go there. It's not like I could do anything differently. So some of it is, you know, bad luck for sure. And some of it is being in those spots that contact occurs, but that's just how I played. So if you take that away from my game, I probably wouldn't have scored half the goals that I scored.
Then you end up, well, forced into retirement. And, how did you then pivot into coaching? Was that like a natural thing for you that here's what I'm going to do? Or what was going through your head in terms of what's next?
Not at all. I actually did not want to be part of coaching. It was tough for me to even be on a soccer field to watch, you know, other people doing what I love, knowing I should be out there and knowing I can't do it anymore. So it was a dark period for about a year and a half where I couldn't even do any physical activity or anything. So couldn't really even get out of the house. So here I am living in Hermosa Beach, steps away from the ocean, and I have to just stay in my room every day. So started going crazy a little bit and said, I need to get out of here. And oddly enough, I said, I'm going to go back to school, finish my degree, and just stay away from soccer. So I found my way back to Charlottesville, Virginia as an undergrad student, where the last time I was there, I was, you know, not taking academics too seriously. And it always stuck with me throughout my professional career. You know, my mom said, hey, listen, I never saw your grades from that last semester. What were your grades like? And I said, Mom, don't worry about my grades. They weren't good, but I promise you I will graduate. And so she's, you know, my parents always place an emphasis on education. So I said, look, that's a promise that I'll keep. So when I was going through all that stuff, I'm like, you know what? I got to get back to the basics here a little bit, get my mind off soccer and, kind of pursue the other thing that I'm passionate about, which is education. And, went back to school and just chipped away at getting my degree. I had to change my major, unfortunately, from econ to actually anthropology, which was quite interesting. Definitely not something that is necessarily going to help me in the long term, but it was the best avenue for me to get my degree at that point. So, and with that said, it actually has helped me in a coaching essence because, you know, to study culture and to know how to deal with people and know how to understand where people are coming from is definitely a great thing to have, whether it's in business or soccer or whatever it is. And so it helped me appreciate, you know, our roots and where we all come from and what drives us all. So I graduated with a degree in anthropology in 2011. And while I was there, I was given the opportunity to then be a voluntary assistant with the UVA men's soccer team while I was taking my classes. And that's where I finally was able to be around the game again. And it was great to be on the college level because these were kids who were just wanting to be professionals and kids who had watched me play and kind of looked up to me. So I said, you know what? I've learned a lot in this game. I've accomplished a lot. I've seen a lot. I've had a lot passed down to me from my dad and other great soccer players. The least I could do now is help these kids out, help them avoid some of the mistakes that I made, help them be more prepared for things than I was or whatever the case may be. And I felt a lot of gratitude, you know, and I was like, man, this is my responsibility. It's not just something that I enjoy. This is a responsibility of mine to pass down all these things. And then I said, okay, maybe coaching is an option, but Peter Novak at that point was with the Philadelphia Union. And he had been asking me for a while to be an assistant coach with him. And I told him I did not want to be a coach. I wanted to do something different to influence kids, to help, you know, pass down everything that I learned. I wasn't ready to be part of back in the professional game yet. So one day he called me and he said, listen, I got the perfect job for you. I want you to be our youth technical director for the academy that we're starting with the Philadelphia Union. So, he brought me in and it was fantastic. I learned a lot and held that position for a little over a year.
You just mentioned that, you know, teaching kids from some of the mistakes that you made, but from the sound of it, you did do almost everything right in terms of being a professional and the way you went about things. What were some of the mistakes in this case that you would look back on?
Yeah, you know, there's a lot that I did wrong and I didn't realize they were necessarily wrong at the time. Some of it's just human nature, you know, just having that patience. And some of it you can't prevent because I'm sure I had my parents in my ear helping me or other people in my ear giving me advice, but some things you just can't control. And especially, you know, on the emotional side. But it's tough to say because, you know, I think all those things that maybe affected me in a negative way also helped me in a positive way as well. So it's kind of a double-edged sword. But, you know, looking back just in terms of with my injuries, for instance, you know, I ignored everyone's advice. I came back from injuries so quickly, I just couldn't stay away. So I played through things that I had no business playing through. And, you know, you always realize after the fact, you know, how your body's your investment. If your body's not right, then you're no use to anyone. And I definitely wore my body out. I gave it everything I had to a fault where I didn't like staying away from it. So if they said it, and it's my competitive side, if you tell me I'm going to be out for 4 weeks, I'm going to be back in 2.5. If you tell me this is how long something takes, I'm going to be back sooner than that. It was a game. You know, I want to be the quickest to recover from this or from that. And in the process, you end up, you know, pushing yourself too much and playing not at 100% or not even at 80% at times. And, you know, for me in my world, it was like, okay, but, you know, my team will appreciate that I'm doing this, you know, for the team. But then you see the business side of it and the lack of loyalty or, you know, respect for the work that you do in some cases, you know, it's more about a business than it is about, you know, what you've done sometimes. And that really was eye-opening to me when I look back on it. I was like, man, you know, I wish I would have taken my time and you know, taken care of my body a bit better to be at the top of my game at all times as opposed to, you know, not being at my best.
After Philly, that was the step over to the New York Cosmos and in 2013.
Yeah,
was because of the history? Or
No, I actually got fired from Philly because Peter Novak brought me in and he got fired from his job. And so they decided to get rid of the guys that he brought in. You know, it's just the way how pro sports work where, you know, a new coach wants to bring in his own guys. And so that again was very discouraging for me where I was like, do I really want to be part of a business where you could be let go for not doing anything wrong? You know, I felt very proud of the work that I did with Philly, with the academy, had a great thing going and, the rug got pulled from under me. So back to the drawing board, trying to figure things out. I kind of dipped and dabbled in different things. I was writing for Sports Illustrated a bit. I did some TV commentary and things like that. Then, Giovanni Savarese called me and another guy that a legend that I looked up to when I was a kid and met with him. He told me about the whole Cosmos project. And all the pieces seemed to fit where it was a no-brainer in terms of what the club has meant to me and my family and how it'd be a perfect opportunity for me to get back in. But it was a very hard decision. I had such a bad taste in my mouth from the way things had ended that I just wasn't sure if I wanted to put myself through that again. But it was a decision that I made collectively with my family, and it was a great decision looking back on it because, first of all, you know, to work with someone like Gio, who I trust and who's, you know, a class act, and someone that I trust, which is very important, but also because, you know, it's a project and there's a lot of challenges and a lot of uncertainties about it. And so it kept me very busy to be creative and try to do the best that I can and learn more about myself as a coach at the professional level.
Have you grown much more sort of cynical towards the game, seeing and going through everything you've gone through? And
I wouldn't say cynical. I'll say I'm a lot more educated about it. And like I said, when you're young and you're playing, it's a very me-centric sport, and you don't see the big picture at all times. And I was, looking back, I could say I was naive. I was naive for thinking that, rather than 2004 when I'm, scoring all those goals, rather than demanding a new contract or something like that, I said, it'll pay off in the end, even though I had everyone in my ear of, you should be getting paid more, you should be doing this. For me, I didn't do it for money. I just felt like, if you do the right things and if you act the right way, you'll be rewarded for it. And that wasn't always the case. So I just learned the business side of it, and I'm much more educated now in terms of how that works. And I don't, have any grudges against anyone or anything. It's just how the world operates. And I still do feel that, if you do things the right way and you treat people the right way, then eventually it'll pay off in the end. So I'm definitely not cynical about it, but I definitely think I was naive at the time.
What are some of the things that you bring to coaching that are unique for you and, based on your experience? And what are the things that you do better than anybody else?
Winning. That's what drives me, man. Whether it's a bet that I can make with you right now here at the table, or a small-sided game, or a 11v11 game, I'm all about winning and trying to figure out how to win. And that even if I lose, I'll find a way how it's really a win, because you learn from it and it helps you in the long run. But that's kind of what drives me. And the obvious answer is, obviously I'm young in terms of a coach, and some of the guys I'm coaching now, I'm younger than, or I played with. So I have the advantage of understanding a player's mentality and what makes them tick, and being able to relate with players on a more personal level, which I really enjoy and I use to my benefit. But at the end of the day, if you aren't doing your job the right way, players will see right through you. If you're not confident in what you're doing, players will see right through you. So I just try to work hard, be confident in the work that I put into it, the preparation that I put into it, which is a lot. And hopefully that will result in me being at my maximum potential with everything that I do. I still have a lot of room to grow as well, and I'm eager to learn more. And I still think that it could branch out to many different parts of the game, not necessarily just as a coach. There's a lot that goes into it. So I'm interested in every part of that aspect, the whole front office technical side of soccer. And so, when I look down the road in terms of aspirations, I think I could use all these different pieces to my benefit.
You work quite a bit with young players, and it's a new generation, obviously, with everything that comes with, both personality wise, but also there is much more attention today, and even at an early age. You've gone through it all. What should this new generation of the young kids or players that you coach, what should they know?
They should know that today in the United States of America, there is more opportunities than ever in the history of this country to be a professional soccer player. The access that we have now for our young players, the training, the clubs, the games on TV, this is a first, for soccer in this country, for soccer players in this country. So they need to understand all the work that has gone behind it to get to this point today, and they need to take advantage of it. The one issue that I see with today's generation is that they're a bit spoiled. And when I say spoiled, yeah, sometimes it relates to their background or maybe their parents or whatever it is. But in some ways, you see a lot of kids these days that they don't have to struggle. And my father always told me, soccer is a poor man's sport. You can't be a rich kid or have a rich kid mentality and excel, because, you always have to have that hunger inside of you. Doesn't matter what your socioeconomic background is, your mentality on the field, you have to have that hunger. You got to be a poor man on the field that's hungry to eat. And too many kids, I feel, are, it's like the YouTube generation where they, you know, watch these highlights on YouTube and they see Cristiano doing these tricks and, you know, they work with the ball. They're a lot more technical now. But now when they face adversity, it's kind of like, whoa, wait a minute. When I was practicing this move in my basement, there was no one pulling my shirt. Like, that's a foul. Referee, that's a foul. He's not letting me do my, you know, and they're mentally weak. Or if a player is not playing, they just change teams. There's, you know, 100 other teams I could go play for. There's not that one team and that's, you got to grind and find a way to make that team. And that is hurting their mental buildup. And you see it, you know, at all levels right now of kids that are turning pro or whatever it is, and very, very talented players who, you know, are amazing talents. But when they don't have that mental capacity to deal with adversity, it doesn't matter how talented you are. And that to me is a big thing that needs to change, you know, culture wise. And there's some kids that have it, that have that buildup, whether it's ingrained in them from their parents or if they're born with it and they just have that drive, those kids make it. But I see a lot of very talented kids who are not making it because of those mental deficiencies. So that's something that you know, we'll need to work on. But that's kind of the next progression of the soccer for the next generation.
David Beckham and the Galaxy clad in blue, the homestanding Red Blues in white.
The distribution through Donovan, through Beckham to open up other players. They have all the variables, options, seeing them. A very quick tempo is going to be important.
Eskandarian! His third game with the Galaxy and his second goal! He's been a Red Bull killer in the past. He's done it again! 1-0 LA, early days.
We're getting towards the end here. I know we could probably go on for a couple more hours. You got a lot to share, but you know, I'm gonna let you go in just a few, and I have just a set of rapid fire questions.
Sure, no problem.
I'll just shoot a few sort of last ones here.
No problem.
What's the biggest moment in your career?
Scoring against Real Madrid.
Biggest moment in your coaching career?
Winning the national championship with Cosmos B.
Best player you've played with?
David Beckham and Christian Gomez as well.
Best player you've played against?
Andrea Pirlo.
Favorite team?
Arsenal.
And as a side note, you are actually wearing an Arsenal hoodie today.
I am. Most days I am.
Dream team to coach?
Arsenal. Realistically, I'll say this, the Armenian national team.
That's an interesting one. Yes. Do you follow them?
I do. You know, a good friend of mine is Yoram Ovsisian, who played with Real Salt Lake, which I kind of helped bring him to that team. And he's had a great, you know, career in MLS and then moving on to Europe in Russia now. But it's been fun to see the growth of Armenia. And I always kind of had a little bit of regret, you know, that I never got to represent Armenia when I was playing. Obviously, I called into the U.S. at a young age, but looking back, I always thought, man, you know, it would have been so much pride to represent that on the world stage. So, as a coaching career, that would definitely be something that I would definitely be interested in.
A coach you look up to and follow?
Bruce Arena and Peter Novak. And of course, my father.
Do you watch yourself on YouTube?
My girlfriend would say yes. I would say no.
You got to explain that.
Well, she never saw me play. So sometimes I have to be like, yeah, this is the life that I had, you know, before I became an old man coaching. So sometimes it's fun. You know, I meet a lot of people who have no idea that I played before. And so it's fun for them to see highlights or videos or whatever it is. And it's fun for me too. It's some nostalgia to see, like, man, I was, you know, I made a lot of references to how I had a crazy mentality and mindset. And, it's much different now. You know, it's a different mentality as a coach. I'm obviously older, more mature and all that stuff. So it kind of is funny to watch, the younger version of me and relive, you know, the things that I was thinking or going through in those moments. It's pretty fun. But I look back on it with a lot of pride. I don't have any regrets over my career or anything like that. I know I gave it everything that I had and left it always out there for the fans and for the team that I was representing.
You get to take three people in the soccer world for dinner and past or present and assume that language is not a barrier. Who are those three and where would you take them?
Now that's a tough one. I would say I'll take Pelé. I'll take Maradona. And I'll take my dad. And there's a funny link there because my dad played with Pelé and my dad played against Maradona. And, you know, just to, I'm very much old school in the game. You know, I'm a historian of the game. I grew up watching tapes. I memorized, you know, the leading score of every World Cup since, you know, the inception and seeing all the great players that paved the way for my dad's generation. And obviously my dad's generation paved the way for my generation and vice versa. So those guys are obviously iconic figures and huge rivals. So to be able to sit with the two of them and be able to talk would be something too. And to have my dad there as well to kind of be an intermediary would be pretty cool as well. So I feel like that would be a pretty amazing.
And at least two of them would probably, I don't know your dad that well, but at least the other two would probably put on a pretty good party.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And where would you take them, by the way?
I would take them to an Armenian restaurant for sure. There's no one that's had a bad time eating some kebab and drinking some red wine. So we'll give them a nice Armenian.
Do we have a good one in New York?
We do. There's a couple of good Persian Armenian restaurants. I was actually just at dinner 2 days ago with Yuri Jarkayev, who is, you know, the best Armenian player maybe of all time, who obviously played for France and won a World Cup and is a legend in any in every way, shape and form. So we went to a nice Persian Armenian meal.
Which one and where is it?
Ravar is what it's called. It's in Midtown.
How can people get hold of you or find out more?
I seem to be pretty active on social media these days. I get made fun of for it, but it's probably the best way for anyone to really reach me. I'm very...
What's your handle?
My handle is at Aleko11. 11 was my jersey number, so I started when I was playing, so I just kept the handle. But, you know, I love the interaction with fans. You know, I always tell everyone I come across, I started this whole thing as a fan. You know, I was a fan of soccer since the day I was born, watching and mimicking. And, you know, I'd be the kid at Giant Stadium trying to get autographs from players. So I never lost that side of me, whether even when I was a player, I would spend the extra 20 minutes, hour, whatever it was to sign every autograph because I know how much it means. And I think that's also important to kind of pay it forward for the growth of the game. So I'll never lose being a fan of the game and that'll always live inside me. So social media is another way to kind of branch out and, you know, engage with fans, even if sometimes on Twitter it's a bit hectic and everyone thinks they know everything about everyone. So sometimes you get a little bit hairy, but overall I enjoy the banter and going back and forth and showing a bit of my own personality as well, because, you know, if I were to judge myself from what I saw on TV, it'd be a very different person than who I am in real life.
I know we've covered quite a bit, but is there anything you would like to recommend?
No. Listen, I think these conversations are important because nothing like this has really been done. Soccer is relatively new. You know, there was the old generation with the old Cosmos that kind of gave a rebirth to soccer. And then there was no professional league for a long time. And now all of us that were kind of part of the earlier years of the league are in some ways considered pioneers. So this is kind of like the NFL films show where, like, you talk to NFL guys who talked about how they played for a couple hundred bucks and now the guys are making millions. So with the way soccer is growing in this country, I think 10 years, 20 years from now, you know, it'll be a huge, huge market on the world stage. And I think it'll grow into one of the best leagues in the world. We're on that path. And, you know, it's guys that I played with and my generation and even before me and this next one coming up after that are all going to shape you know, how well we do as a nation. So these conversations are important just to, you know, tell people what it's like and give them the realities and the behind the scenes version. So I appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you. I really appreciate that note. That's very much what the purpose of this, of these types of conversations are. So thank you. Last question. Who do you think I should interview on this podcast next?
Jeff Mateo is who I think you should interview because he's the most influential soccer person in New York City. So I'm going to say Jeff Mateo is who you should interview.
Maybe you can put in a good word.
I'll see what I could do.
Aleko, thank you so much. It's been a true pleasure. I did a little bit of research, obviously, before and looking at who I should be talking to, and I figured that you would be an interesting character. But this has been much more than that, and I think there's a lot of great lessons for anybody following in your footsteps or anybody in just in life and in general. It's been an absolute pleasure, and thank you so much, and best of luck.
Again. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening. I truly appreciate it. If you enjoy this podcast, subscribe to it in iTunes or on the podcast app. Please write a review. If you have any feedback or ideas, feel free to email me at sebastian@coffeeandfootball.com. You can also link up with me via Twitter. It's @coffeesfootball. Check out the coffeeandfootball.com website. There you'll find any related content and additional info on each guest. This show also lives on SoundCloud and Acast. Thanks again. Stay tuned for next week's episode. It'll go up on Monday or Tuesday. And after that, it'll be one new episode per week.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.